headlines, North Korea says a new U.S. alliance in the Indo-Pacific region and its submarine contract with Australia could trigger a, quote, nuclear arms race. The crisis hit Haiti calls on the U.S. to stop the mass deportation of migrants, saying it cannot handle thousands of homeless deportees. Also, the Yemeni army gains control of a strategic area in the central province of Marib in its battle against Saudi-led coalition forces. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, France has reportedly canceled a defense minister's meeting with Britain after Australia scrapped a submarine order with Paris in favor of a deal with Washington and London. Two sources familiar with the matter said the meeting was due to be held this week. France is outraged after Australia scrapped a multi-billion-dollar 2016 deal with a French naval group to build a dozen conventional submarines. Australia instead entered a pact to build at least 8 nuclear-powered subs with U.S. and British technology. France has accused the U.S. and Australia of lying and duplicity. Australia has said it understands France's disappointment, but it has acted in its national best interests. Britain has also said the pact shows London's readiness to be hard-headed in defending its own interests. That is why North Korea says the new U.S. alliance in the Indo-Pacific region and a submarine contract with Australia could trigger a, quote, nuclear arms race. An official from the country's foreign ministry has called the moves extremely undesirable and dangerous acts which will upset the strategic balance in the region. The official described the U.S. as the chief culprit disrupting the international nuclear non-proliferation system. The North Korean diplomat noted that the move is widely seen as aimed at countering the rise of China. Haiti has protested the United States' mass deportation of migrants, calling on Washington to stop sending them back home. Haitian authorities say the country is in crisis and cannot handle thousands of homeless deportees. This comes as many of the migrants say they wouldn't like to return as they see no future for themselves and their families in their home country. Some 14,000 Haitians are expected to be expelled from the U.S. over the coming weeks. The first batch arrived on Sunday afternoon. Political commentator Yamir Chabur believes deporting Haitians from the U.S. is a break of Joe Biden's campaign promise to welcome migrants to America. Listen.
Yeah, the Biden administration is continuing the Trump administration policies when it comes towards immigration and deporting the amount of Haitians that have migrated and have risked their lives coming from their islands to South America to the Rio Grande border out in Texas. This is just a continuation of U.S. policy. So it is immoral, given all these circumstances and these facts, that the Biden administration, which was an administration that said it was standing with immigrants, that it was against Trump's xenophobia, racism, the fact that they were campaigning that immigrants are welcomed here, that they continue with Trump's policy of deportation, as we see present right now as they deport these Haitian migrants.
The Yemeni army has seized control of the strategic Wadi Nakhla area in the country's central province of Marib. The army has engaged in fierce clashes with troops affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition and Al-Qaeda elements there. Abdullatif Al-Washili joined us earlier with more details.
The Yemeni army is determined to liberate the whole matter from the Saudi-backed forces and also the terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. The Yemeni army captured and liberated Wadi Nakhla area following intense clashes with the elements of Al-Qaeda and also the Saudi-backed forces. This area lies northwest of the capital of Marib. It is a new victory for the Yemeni army after liberating 1,600 square kilometers, including Madghal and also Majdar Directorate. Mass camp was also captured by the Yemeni army, backed by local tribes. This camp is considered one of the largest camps used by the Saudi coalition during the past years. So the Yemeni army continues advancing toward the city and is proving that it is really determined and serious about liberating the city of Marib from the foreign presence.
Palestinian political activist and scholar Hanan Ashrawi says the recent prison break by a number of detainees showed even Israel's most secure jails are incapable of limiting their freedom.
These are Palestinians unjustly imprisoned in many cases and unlawfully kept within prisons in Israel and judged by a military court of the occupation. So, and kept in one of the most secure prisons in Israel, Gilboa, and they managed persistently and in an amazing way to dig this tunnel, to be able to find their way to freedom. It gave the Palestinians a sense of hope, a boost of morale, that even Israel's most militarily secured location is not immune to the Palestinian spirit and yearning to be free.
Ashrawi said all Palestinians are united in defending and supporting the inmates who managed to escape from the Israeli prison. She noted that people across Palestine show solidarity with the prisoners because their land has been held captive by the Israeli regime. The former Palestinian official said the prison break is also an indication that the detainees are totally committed to their freedom.
But the issue is that there is this dedication, there is this total commitment to achieving their freedom, to seeing their families, to, as one person said, 5 days smelling the fresh air of Palestine, of looking at Palestine, of eating some of the fruits and so on, is equal to a lifetime in prison. This is the kind of spirit, undefeated spirit, of the Palestinian people. They add the term terrorist to it.
Ashrawi further said Israel's attempt to diminish such achievements is typical, and the regime has been doing so for decades. She added that Tel Aviv has been trying to distort and undermine Palestinian struggle as a whole, including that of the freedom fighters in Palestine. Ashrawi stressed that the regime in Tel Aviv uses every possible means, including utter lawlessness, against the captive population of Palestine. The activists also called on the Israeli regime to liberate all Palestinians from its jails. Palestinian officials say Israel has made mass arrests in the occupied territories in response to a high-security prison break earlier this month. We'll discuss this matter further with our guests in our news review program. Let's hear what they had to say.
Sign up for news review segments where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Palestinian officials say Israel has carried out mass arrests in the occupied territories in response to a high-security prison break earlier this month. More than 100 Palestinians have been arrested. That's according to the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Prisoners Organization. They said they had documented an average of 14 arrests a day since the jailbreak on September 6. Children and students are among the detainees. As part of its crackdown after the jailbreak, Israel also raided several Palestinian organizations in the West Bank. The regime launched the crackdown to recapture 6 Palestinian prisoners who had escaped from a high-security Israeli jail. Joining us on this edition of the News Review program is Paul Larudi from the Free Palestine Movement, and we also have John Elmer, a journalist and researcher. Gentlemen, welcome. And Paul, if I can start with you, do you sense that Israel is perhaps taking its anger out on the Palestinians with this arrest campaign because of, you know, because it failed? There was a prison break and there was a security breach.
I wouldn't do too much to emotional reactions in Israel. Israel will use every development as an excuse to further its goals of ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinians, to rid Palestine of Palestinians. And that's what this is about. I mean, they can use this as a pretext to disrupt the lives and arrest large numbers of Palestinians that eventually they probably would arrest, or who knows, if they pursue them, they might find reasons to harm them. So this is just a pretext. They don't really believe that coming down harder on the Palestinians is going to reduce the resistance. If they're honest, they will realize that the Palestinians are likely to increase their resistance the more oppression Israel applies to them.
Right. John, what's your views on this the collective punishment by the Israel? At the end of the day, it was just six Palestinians who dug out of an Israeli prison.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lack of human intelligence, so there was signals intelligence that they used, but they arrested family members, which is something that they usually do, harass people. I actually think that Israel was quite careful with this. They were really unsure how the prisoners inside the prisons were going to respond. There was talk of a hunger strike. There was riots inside the prisons. I think Israel was concerned about what had happened in the Gaza Strip in May, where there was really no resolution to the mini war that happened. And that war was justified by Hamas as standing up for Palestinians in the West Bank as an attempt to unify the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So I think with these prisoners, Israel was actually took it quite carefully, I think, compared to how they could have done it. Worried about the resistance, worried about inflaming the reaction. The Palestinian prisoners in Palestinian society have overwhelming support. To push back against the prisoners is something that Israel really doesn't see in its interest, and especially in this case where the whole world was watching.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly did see some remarkable resistance in Jenin during that intifada. Quite unexpected. Paul, would you agree that Jenin, that was some resistance the soldiers, the men, the Palestinians put up?
That's correct. It was the strongest point of resistance. There and Nablus were both strong resistance points in 2002 against the occupation. But Jenin paid the price because a good portion of the camp was leveled to the ground, and nevertheless the resistance has continued ever since that time. To say that the Israelis exercise restraint, I'm reminded of a Zionist at a university here in the States where I was speaking many years ago, and he made the claim that the Israelis were being had shown restraint in Gaza by only killing 1,000 Palestinians there. And I said, how do you call that restraint? And he said, well, we have the opportunity to kill all of them. Restraint is a strange way to characterize what Israel has done in by exercising massive collective punishment and arrest of Palestinians. Certainly, the Palestinians that I've spoken to did not consider it to be a restraint. They considered it to be an onerous way of trying to crush the Palestinians.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their time and their contribution. Paul Larudi there from the Free Palestine Movement joining us out of Berkeley, and John Elmer, journalist and researcher, joining us out of Toronto. And that brings an end to another edition of the News Review program.
Russia's ruling party is on course to retain a majority in the country's parliamentary elections. With 33% of ballots counted, the Central Election Commission said the United Russia Party that supports President Vladimir Putin has received over 45% of the vote. Its main rival, the Communist Party, is in the second place with around 22% of the ballots. In the last parliamentary elections in 2016, United Russia won just over 54% of the vote. The party currently holds two-thirds majority in the parliament. A volcano has erupted on the Spanish Canary island of La Palma, sending jets of lava and a plume of smoke and ash into the air. Authorities had begun evacuating people and farm animals from the surrounding villages before the eruption. Immediately after the eruption, the municipality urged residents in a statement to, quote, exercise extreme caution. Experts said they couldn't be sure how long the eruption would last. La Palma has been on high alert since 1971 due to a major eruption, and it is one of the most active volcanic regions in the Canaries. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News. Thank you for staying through.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Photos and videos from different scenes show Israeli settlers and troops from the IDF aiming their weapons toward the Palestinian villagers, says Yuval Abraham, journalist, in an article titled, On a Single Day in May, Israeli Settlers and Troops Cooperated in Attacks That Left 4 Palestinians Dead. Stay tuned for more. Nidal Safadi was a quiet man, his neighbor said. He lived in Orif, a Palestinian village of several thousand people in the West Bank. Just 25, Safadi had three children with his wife and a fourth girl on the way. Orif is not always quiet. At the Palestinian city of Nablus, less than 10 miles away, the occupying Israeli regime military established a base on a nearby hilltop in 1983. A year later, it was turned over to civilian purposes, part of Israeli regime's illegal settlement program in the Palestinian territories. Since 2000, a settlement called Yechar has been home to a yeshiva known for its hardline Jewish nationalist views. The settlement became known for its extremism. The so-called outpost settlements, it has spared, illegal even by Israeli regime law, but nonetheless defended by the Israeli regime forces, have gradually encroached on villages like Orif. Over the past 10 years, settler aggressions have given rise to violent recriminations between the Israelis and Palestinians living nearby. On May 14th, though, Orif was calm, unlike much of the West Bank. In dozens of places around the territory, Palestinians protested against recent Israeli regime provocations, police storming, Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and heavy bombardment. Shahada said a group of settlers arrived at about 2 p.m., along with six troops, and began wreaking havoc. The settlers uprooted almost 60 fig and olive trees, he said. Then they attacked the school with stones and broke its solar panels. The damage was still evident when I visited a month after the attack. While the settlers did all of that, the troops covered for them by gunfire, Shahada continued. The troops led, gave orders, everything looked coordinated. The troops pointed for the settlers, where to go, where to uproot, and then they shot at anybody who tried to get close. After a few minutes, residents came to protect the village. One of the villagers who arrived was Nidal Safadi. Nidal arrived at the school terrified, said his brother, who asked that his name not be used for fear of retribution. We have relatives who live nearby, and the mosque's loudspeaker announced that the settlers were attacking, so he ran. Photos and videos from different scenes show settlers and troops from IDF aiming their weapons toward the Palestinian villagers. One video obtained by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem shows a shirtless settler with a face covering walking around and chatting with nearby troops. At one point, the settler armed with an automatic rifle stands directly in front of a troop, takes aim toward the villagers, and opens fire. Other photos shows settlers and troops alike with weapons raised. Amid the chaos, Safadi struck by four bullets in the chest and abdomen, according to Shahada. He died of his wounds. We do not know whether it was a settler or a troop who shot him, Shahada said. We had many who were wounded by gunfire that day. Nine people were hurt. One in the abdomen, another was shot 3 centimeters from his heart, and there was Nidal who got killed. Shahada went on, it was a planned attack, revenge, not a confrontation. We used to have clashes every day and it never looked like that. They didn't use live ammunition before, only tear gas and rubber bullets. Also, more troops used to be present. Safadi's death was one of 11 violent killings of Palestinians in the West Bank on May 14th, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. While Israeli regime media reported that the killings occurred amid clashes, implying the widespread protest over Al-Aqsa and Gaza bombings, at least four of the deaths occurred during deliberate attacks by settlers and troops on Palestinian villages, an investigation by Local Call and The Intercept found. The joint attacks by Israeli settlers and troops were not linked to protests in the targeted villages. No demonstrations preceded the violence in three of the four locations. The incursions all occurred at almost the same time, around 2 p.m., and all involved the settlers destroying agricultural land, including by setting fires as well as stone throwing and the use of live ammunition. Attacks on Palestinians by stone throwing settlers, as Israeli troops stand idly by, are a common occurrence in the occupied Palestinian territories. But scenes like those from May 14th, settlers and troops attacking villages in apparent cooperation with live ammunition, are unprecedented. The only way I can describe this by calling it militias, said Gunamer Mershad Assad, an attorney and a partner in Hagel Jews and Arabs in Defense of Human Rights, an organization that works in the court system to represent Palestinians who have faced settler violence. These cases in which troops enter villages together with settlers and in which there is massive gunfire by settlers, this is unprecedented. Five such attacks on May 14th left four Palestinians dead. One was killed in the village of Asira al-Qibliya in the Nablus area, another in Iskaka near Israeli settlement Ariel, a third in the village of Al-Rihaya in South Mount Hebron, and Nidal Safadi in Orif. In the fifth village, Burin, which is also near Nablus, a similar attack ended without any deaths. Videos, photographs, and villagers' testimonies of the attacks indicate that, in at least three cases, Israeli settlers and troops acted as a combined fighting unit, effectively working as a joint militia attacking civilians and firing interchangeably at Palestinian residents. Coordination between the military and settlers is a burgeoning political issue in the occupied territories. Recently, 100 former combat troops sent a letter to Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz, demanding he take action against settler violence that they themselves had witnessed during their service. In the past year, settler violence has intensified and manifested in, among other things, property destruction, stone throwing, and physical violence against Palestinians, the former troops wrote, adding, "We are the ones who witness how the lords of the land behave unrestricted and what this violence looks like on the ground. We were sent to defend them, but were not given the tools to deal with them." Local Call and Intercept sent a detailed description of the findings to an IDF spokesperson, including photographs and footage. The spokesperson said the cases are under processes of checking and investigating. Though the IDF spokesperson declined to comment on many of the specifics, they acknowledged in response to one of the photographs showing a settler closely interacting with an IDF officer in Orif that the settler was in the area without permission. No autopsy was carried out on Safadi's body nor on those of the other Palestinians killed that day, so there is no way of determining whether troops or settlers were responsible for the deaths. Israeli regime police have not announced any inquiries into the killings. Despite the common time frame and modus operandi, there is no evidence that the May 14th attacks were coordinated. Some settler ideologues, though, did note that the confluence of events, Zevi Sukkot, a spokesperson of the settlement Yitzhar and a rising online star of the movement, posted photos from some of the incidents on the Facebook. The photos he shared show, among other things, said that Palestinian with a bullet in his head and another with a bleeding chest, as well as a host of bodies lying prone in various settings. The security situation in Samaria is excellent. No need for protest, Sukkot wrote in his Facebook post, asking his fellow settlers to stay at home. He used the common Israeli term Samaria to describe the northern West Bank. There are casualties, lots of people injured, and serious trauma on the Arab side, he wrote. In all my years in Samaria, I do not remember the army being that determined. Many village residents interviewed by local Call and Intercept attributed the attacks to revenge by both troops and settlers, apparently for protest against the Israeli regime assaults on Al-Aqsa and Gaza, as well as unrest in mixed cities inside the occupied territories. The incursions fit into a pattern of so-called price tag attacks, where settlers launch retributive assaults on anyone deemed to be even remotely viewed as an obstacle to their movement. The yeshiva in Yajar near Orif was instrumental in formulating the religious justification for price tag attacks. The concept gained notoriety among some Israeli Jews because it rationalized attacks against the Israeli regime military in rare cases where, for instance, the IDF was used to evacuate settlement outposts. The most common targets of price tag attacks, however, are Palestinian civilians. On May 14th, troops were far from being targets or even ineffectual bystanders. Instead, they were active participants and collaborators in the joint assaults. The army now perceives the settlers as an auxiliary fighting force, said Mishadi Saad, the human rights lawyer, adding, the cooperation is more transparent. No one is ashamed of it. The troops see the settlers as a backing force. It is very noticeable. And the settlers, too, are more fearless. It's clear that things have become more organized over the last year.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. Let us listen to another bezel of wisdom from Imam Musa Kazim, peace be upon him, the seventh Imam of the household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Plants grow in plain, not rocky lands. In the same way, wisdom will grow in the hearts of the modest, not the arrogant. Because God has made modesty the instrument of the mind, and made arrogance the instrument of ignorance. Do you not notice that he who raises the head to the ceiling will have his head bruised? Likewise, he who bends down will enjoy the shades and the protection of the ceiling. Similarly, God will disgrace those who do not behave humbly to him, and will exalt those who humble themselves for him.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program For a Better Life. So, what is a better life? The answer is when a person is happy. That this happiness is not the material happiness where I look for a good job, a good spouse, a handsome guy, and a nice bank balance. No. It is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Difu, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. So how can I become a better person? In the very first session, we said that the first step to become a better person is Ya'udha, which is to wake up. Wake up from what? Wake up from a deep sleep of negligence. Wake up from ghafla. In the last session, we talked about waking up. Now let us continue with our discussion. We said once we are awakened, we should be alert. We should not give ourselves the benefit of doubt. We should not trust ourselves. We should not say, "I'm good," and then stop. Because that might lead to ghafla again. Ayatullah Jawadi Amali explains it beautifully. He said, we should never feel good about ourselves. We should carry ill feelings about ourselves. Because if I feel good about myself, then I will never see my mistakes and will never repent and never ask for forgiveness. But mind you, man should not harbor ill feelings for others. It is always good to give the benefit of doubt for others. For example, let's say a sister was rude to him. Then he should say, maybe she didn't mean it. Maybe she was tired. Or maybe she was overwhelmed. Or probably she was stressed. And so on. But for him, it is good to harbor ill feelings. When man harbors ill feelings for himself, he will not think that he is a good person and that he does good deeds. Instead, he will think that there is a possibility that he might make mistakes or, God forbid, go astray. Consequently, he will not evaluate his deeds to be correct immediately. Instead, he will evaluate them according to Allah's scale, keeping Allah in mind. Brothers and sisters, we shall get back after a short break.
we built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand it crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied?
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. We were talking about that how a person should not harbor ill feelings for others, but he should harbor ill feelings for himself. Because if he harbors these ill feelings for himself, it will put him on guard to always examine his deeds before he comes to a conclusion. Sometimes Allah really gives blessings, gives ni'mah to someone, but sometimes he might be testing someone with blessings. For example, let's say I want to test my son, so I give him a $10 bill and I say, here, have this. And my son, he thinks good about himself and he thinks like, whoa, I've been a good guy, that's why mama is gifting this to me and I deserve this, it's a reward. And he goes and let's say he parties and he's spending it on movies and junk. And here I'm testing him, right? So I'll go like, this boy does not need, he does not deserve this. So next time I'm not going to give it to him, right? But let's say if he spends it in a good cause or he saves it, then I will be encouraged to give him more. So it's the same with Allah. Sometimes he blesses us, he gives us ni'mah just to test us. For example, in Quran, we see the word bala that has been used in different meanings. Sometimes it has been used for a test through suffering and calamities called ni'mat, and sometimes for a test through a blessing, ni'mat. Now, what are the tests in the form of a blessing? Are there any examples in Quran? Yes, Quran narrates in the story of Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam that when he saw the throne of the Queen of Saba in his court, he said, "Hada min fadli Rabbi." This is by the grace of my Lord to test me if I will give thanks or be ungrateful. And whoever gives thanks only for his own sake. And whoever is ungrateful, my Lord is indeed all-sufficient, all-generous. Why did Prophet Sulaiman say this? Let's look into the story of Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam. Now, who was he? He was a prophet and he ruled Jerusalem. His rule extended from the people to the jinns and animals and birds. One day in his assembly, he saw a bird missing. When the bird returned, it came back with the news from the kingdom of Saba, saying that it was ruled by a woman who worshipped the sun and she had a great throne. Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam decided to invite the queen to Islam in submission to the creator of the sun. He was saying, worship the sun, don't worship the sun, worship the creator of the sun. So he decides to write a letter to her. But instead of responding to the letter, she sent him a gift to test if he's a worldly king, eager for material gifts, or a godly king, eager to worship the true Lord of the universe. Now she's also testing him. So Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam saw that she was trying to bribe him with worldly gifts, which have no value versus divine gifts, so he threatened to invade her kingdom as she rejected his call to submit to the Lord of the universe. So see, brothers and sisters, how, like when a person harbors these ill feelings, he knows that every gift that Allah has given is a test. And how Prophet Sulaiman also, when he saw the throne in his court, he says, this is to test me. So let's pray to Allah that we also are cautious and harbor the ill feelings about ourselves and are always, always scrutinizing our deeds so that we become a better person that will lead us to have a better life. Insha'Allah. Wa akhiru da'wahum anil hamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need. So I need. All I need. Is all I need.
The light.
Visitors and keepers of a zoo in the Peruvian capital Lima are thrilled over the birth of 8 baby penguins from the vulnerable Humboldt species. Zookeepers say the chicks were hatched in July and they're expecting 6 more additions later in October. Currently, the newborns spend their days resting in their nests and being fed by their parents. The Huachipa Zoo currently has 42 Humboldt penguins and is working on recovering the species population.
We have 8 2-month-old chicks and 6 eggs. In 42 days, those eggs will hatch and the chicks will come out. The important thing about Humboldt penguins is that we are recovering their population because they are in a vulnerable state. We are increasing their populations with the breeding we are doing in the zoo.
Researchers say a maximum of less than 10,000 Humboldt penguins are left in the wild, with their population size undergoing extreme fluctuations. The species face emerging threats from agricultural activities to their own vulnerability to predators. The Humboldt penguins are only found along the Pacific coast of Chile and Peru and are enlisted as threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
A passionate Indian teacher has turned a road into a classroom and houses walls into blackboards to make up for the prolonged school shutdown caused by COVID-19. Deep Narayan Nayak is working with nearly 60 students in a small tribal village in the eastern state of West Bengal. He started to teach students, most of whom are first-generation learners, last year, when all local schools closed under lockdown restrictions. Nayak says that he was worried about his students' education since many of them did not have access to smartphones or internet connection. But thanks to his initiative, his students can learn everything from popular nursery rhymes to the importance of masks.
We are teaching children everything, how to maintain social distancing, how to wear a mask, what is the importance of masks and hand washing. The children came forward and participated in this initiative, and they are also educating others.
The parents and villagers are grateful to Nayak, saying that they are happy their children are no longer wasting their time loitering around in the village. Nayak is now popularly known as the teacher of the street. among the villagers. Water scarcity is a significant and accelerating problem for people worldwide. A UK-based charity, WaterAid, has installed life-size ice sculptures in London to show the fragility of water and the threat posed by climate change.
Climate change is water change, so it means that droughts will get longer, which means that previous reliable sources of water just won't be there. It means that flooding, sometimes in the same country, becomes very severe, polluting water sources and destroying infrastructure. But it also means unpredictability. Water sources that people have relied on for generations, for farming as well as for their health and hygiene, are just no longer there.
Farr, a policy analyst for WaterAid, said people with no access to clean water are bearing the brunt of climate change. The sculptures opposite Tower Bridge are part of the charity's fight, which calls on the British government to increase funding for climate adaptation. The sculptures show how clean water is essential for human survival, with some being depicted carrying buckets and pots in search of water. The environmental group wanted to highlight the threat climate change poses to our planet.
Egyptian archaeologists have completed the renovation of a tomb of an ancient king, providing a rare glimpse into the world's oldest known pyramid. The 4,700-year-old Step Pyramid was built during the reign of King Djoser. The southern tomb is the second for the king, and it is smaller compared to royal tombs. Some researchers suggest it was built for the preservation of Djoser's internal organs, while others say it was built symbolically. It had been undergoing renovation for 15 years before being reopened to the public.
120 tons of blocks were raised by Egyptian hands, astonishingly, and with the determination to achieve one goal. That is the reconstruction of the tomb, just as it was 4,700 years ago.
The complex is historically significant, as it is the earliest known example of the Egyptian custom of pharaohs being buried in pyramid-shaped tombs. According to experts, ancient Egyptians believed that this step design served as a gigantic stairway of the soul of a deceased pharaoh that could ascend to the heavens. Now, we've all grown up playing with a pinball machine at least once in our lifetime. Now, a free runner has designed a giant scaled-up pinball machine, turning it into his personal playground. Latvian free runner Paša Petkuns came up with the idea of playing on real-life pinball machines during a road trip. The set, made in London, is not for the faint-hearted, as it is slanted at a 45-degree angle. Paša thought his breakdancing experience might help, but in the end, he had to invent a whole new style of movement. The producer of the film, showing the performance on the machine, described the set as very scary.
It's 17 meters high, it's 16 meters wide, and 20 meters long. It's an angle of 45 degrees, and I don't know if you understand how much 45 degrees is. It's like, it's a double black diamond slope. It's something you don't go down, you can't, because it's more like falling than anything else.
It does sound scary. Now, the impressive set, designed to look like a retro pinball machine you might find in arcades, took 7 weeks to construct. Global landmarks like the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty are featured in it. Petkuns works as a Hollywood stunt double. Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues, as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. But a young Spanish designer is dedicating his time to the cause of recycling plastic waste. 28-year-old Humberto Les quit his job last year to focus full-time on his environmental efforts. He collects trash from the coast of his home island of Gran Canaria. Humberto usually picks up an average of 5 kilos from the shore at a time, After he is done compiling, he processes the material and turns it into pieces of furniture. Umberto's aim is to make the task of recycling plastic economically justifiable, that is.
I decided to leave my job, stability, to come back here to develop a project to clean the coastline by designing furniture, because I realized that the coast could not be cleaned in an altruistic manner. So I found a way to give economic value to the waste found in the coast.
Umberto is making products ranging from clothes hangers to stools, but he also wants to create larger products with a longer lifespan in the future. According to the UN Environment Programme, only 9% of all plastic waste produced throughout history has ever been reprocessed. Around 80% of it remains accumulated in dumps, landfills, or nature.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A floating concert venue has entertained music lovers in London. Renowned pianist Masayuki Tayama and his partner started the project to play on a canal boat traversing the city's waterways 2 months ago. Since then, they have performed 9 concerts, and their upcoming performances are already sold out in months ahead. The couple came up with the idea after living on a narrow boat with a digital piano.
This is the piano boat, which is the only canal boat of its kind. It was built to our specifications as a floating concert venue. So we have a brand new Steinway grand piano, and here we give musical experiences for people on the canals.
The artists believe the experience is very different from playing in regular concert halls. They say recitals on the boat create a unique interaction with the audience and it feels friendlier. A small fairy pigeon invader has interrupted a cricket match in Ireland. A playful puppy ran into the field of a semi-final match and caught the ball. The scene caused laughter amongst those present. After a few minutes of chasing the dog, players managed to get the ball back. The funny video has gone viral on the internet.
A caiman and a local tour guide in Bolivia's Amazon region have formed an unlikely friendship with bond going viral on the internet. Although people are warned to stay away from caimans, Alejandro Gil has struck up a friendship with one special reptile named Jesus. Despite the caiman's carnivorous nature, it shakes his tail and allows Gil to pat it on the head after being fed. At 4 meters long, Gil, however, admits that getting close to Jesus does still make him nervous.
My knees shake when I work with Jesus. I'm always scared and very careful, and also respectful to tourists. Guides in the Pampa de Yacuma and across Bolivia consult with tourists before undertaking an activity. If they agree with it, then we do it. If one person is not in agreement with an activity, then we don't do it.
Gil says they are only able to get in touch with a caiman in a dry season when the river is at low water levels. They lose the reptile in January when the river rises. Caimans inhabit Mexico, Central and Northern South America, from marshes and swamps to mangrove rivers and lakes. Their diet consists of a great deal of fish, but caimans also hunt insects, birds, and small mammals and reptiles. A A new initiative has been launched to turn the spotlight on the misery of Syrians.